From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment. This week, for your arts update, we look at art from a few different angles. Best-selling author Sam Keen finds the stories behind the science. Musician Galen Lee uses her voice to dismantle barriers for people with physical disabilities. And writers Norma Wilson and Jerry Wilson spend time exploring the seasons of South Dakota while staying keenly aware of their place in the world at large. Let's get started. Sam Keen writes science books. The Disappearing Spoon, The Violinist's Thumb, The Dueling Neurosurgeons. If you haven't explored his work yet, think the nerdiest of NPR Science Friday combined with the storytelling grace of This American Life. His newest book is called The Bastard Brigade, and it's the true story of the scientists, spies, and saboteurs who raced to keep Nazi Germany from developing an atomic weapon during the desperate days of World War II. Sam Keen joined us in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios to share one of the most nail-biting scientific adventures of our time. Sam, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I told you before we started, this is my favorite book so far.
And thank you.
Sam Keen doesn't miss in his books, but this one is somewhat of a departure for you, at least structurally. There's a lot of material here. Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges of putting such a massive story together.
It was, yeah. So in my other books, I kind of had a central idea, like the human genome, the human brain, something, and then I would kind of spin stories off from there. And in those books, it was almost like a collection of short stories in that there was a central theme, but different chapters had different characters involved, things like that. This book is a bit more like a novel in that there are a few central characters who keep coming up over and over again. So you have some Nobel Prize winners, you have spies, Major League Baseball players, the Kennedy brothers. They just keep coming back. And so it was a challenge to sort of build things, build characters slowly, bring them back. And writing the book itself also involved a lot more, you know, going to archives, digging through unread letters, unpublished memoirs, things like that. So a different process of writing the book, but it was a lot of fun to do as well.
Thousands of books and original documents and primary sources and just the amount of research. Tell us a little bit about, you know, kind of wrangling all of that and not getting lost in the research itself.
It is sometimes a bit of a challenge when you come home with a huge stack of papers that you have to wade through. But really with this book, what drives it, I think, are the characters. Again, the people involved. And as long as you're, I think, keeping focus on the people and trying to either understand what they were like as human beings or what they were actually doing and kind of keep those two things in mind, their character, traits, personalities, and also the plot, the action, everything has to relate back to that. So as long as you're kind of keeping those two things in mind, you're really getting to know them as people. And once you do that, it's like sitting down and writing about a friend or something like that. You kind of know them, and then it's easier, I think, at that point.
All right. So as I tell people about this book, a lot of them look at me and say, is it fiction or is it nonfiction? I'm like, no, I'm explaining it as if it's fiction because it's that exciting and it's such an adventure and there's all these, you know, sort of plot points and characters. But this is all a true story of what really happened during this time. How much of this is really kind of never been, we don't know some of these stories when you put them all together.
Yeah, some of the characters, as I said, they had unpublished memoirs, unpublished letters, things like that, that have never really been talked about before, never really been published or gone through before. So in some cases, you know, there had been a bit about the story here or there. I don't think anyone had really brought them all together into one book and really discussed, you know, the big fear that scientists had in the U.S. that Nazi Germany was way ahead of us on atomic weapons research for various reasons. They, in fact, founded their version of the Manhattan Project. They called it the Uranium Club. They founded that 2 full years before we did, and they really had the best scientists in the world there. So knowing that, scientists in the U.S. were terrified that they were way ahead of us and that they were going to build an atomic bomb and hand it to Adolf Hitler, and he was going to destroy the world with it. So that fear really drove them, I think, and really pushed them on. And no one had really brought that together from the sort of American side of why they were so afraid, and then their response to it, trying to, you know, spy on and sabotage, and in some cases even try to assassinate members of the Nazi atomic bomb project.
So this research starts before the rise of Hitler. All this, the scientific advancement, why are we so behind is the question. Why, how did we get that far behind?
Well, basically, it was the fact that Europe at the time was the center of science in the world. People from the United States, if they wanted to be a good professional scientist at the time, they had to go to Europe and do a fellowship or a postdoc and when they were in Europe. So the basic reason was Europe was where all the best science was going on at the time, and especially in Germany. Germany was the world leaders, not only in pure research, things like discussing and discovering atomic fission, but also things like industrial research, which are very important for making an atomic bomb. So they were the world leaders in all of these different fields, which is why we were so afraid that they were going to, that they basically had the inside track on the atomic bomb.
But they're not thinking about an atomic bomb at first. They're doing this research and they're trying to figure out the things that now we sort of take for granted scientifically are known. Mm-hmm. Take us back a little bit, because there's even the scientists don't, are, it's starting to dawn on them what can be done with some of this research. Take us back to those early days of what are they trying to find and how are they competing with each other to advance science, physics in particular, and how does it evolve into this is a military use, this is a weapon, this is the greatest weapon we've ever seen.
Yeah, so basically what happens is they were really curious about, you know, like the structure of the atom, different properties of it. And you had people like Irene Juliette Curie, who was Marie Curie's daughter. She's one of the major characters in the book, some other scientists involved. And frankly, they were just curious. They liked this stuff. They liked studying it. They thought it was really interesting. And the beginning of the book actually takes you through some of the science they were doing, and especially the slow dawning realization. So you're sort of following along with them as even they realize how dangerous this is going to be. I think there was a sense that it was just sort of this pure research at first. Then they realized it might have applications. They know it might have dangerous applications, but it was sort of only a theoretical worry. And then there was a big discovery in Germany where they realized, uh-oh, this actually could be very dangerous. So at the beginning of the book, you're really following along with the scientists as even they are realizing just how dangerous this atomic research could be if it fell into the wrong hands.
Let's talk about some of those characters, and you mentioned Irene. Tell us a little bit about her, because she has not only a very interesting pre-war story, but during the war, she's doing some pretty interesting things, trying to keep things out of the hands of Nazi Germany. Who is she, other than being the daughter of Marie Curie?
Yeah, so she was always kind of overshadowed by her mother in some ways, and they had a bit of a rocky relationship. Marie could be very harsh, very demanding on her, and so Irene was always, I think, trying to kind of impress her mother and live up to her expectations. So she had a lot of kind of personal drama with her mother, eventually kind of set out on her own. She married a man named Frederick Joliet, and they became kind of a husband and wife scientific team. And their big discovery was they discovered something called artificial radioactivity. So some elements are naturally radioactive. They naturally fall apart. They decay. Other elements, you can make them radioactive through various processes. And they discovered this artificial way of making elements radioactive. They didn't realize it quite at first, but this is one of those dawning moments where eventually it became clear by using some of the things they discovered, you could initiate something called a chain reaction. And a chain reaction is really the key to an atomic bomb. So they sort of inadvertently discovered this key process of, you know, helping to make a chain reaction, which if you harness properly, can lead to an atomic bomb. So they sort of stumbled into this. They ended up winning the Nobel Prize for it. But as I talk about in the book, it was actually a ceremony, a Nobel Prize ceremony, where Frederick talked about this chain reaction idea. And then shortly after that, there was a German biologist, actually, who showed up, and kind of out of the blue, he threw his hand in the air and did this fascist salute. He did the Sieg Heil Nazi salute at the Nobel Prize ceremony. So even at these early moments, you have Nazi politics and atomic weapons kind of colliding, and eventually they really collided as we moved into the beginning of the war.
All right, so let's jump ahead a little bit just for Irene's purpose, because she has an inheritance from her mother that becomes very important during the war, and I just love this story. So tell us a little bit about one of her challenges in protecting her inheritance.
Sure. So I should say Marie, her mother, had this gram of a substance called radium, which is highly radioactive, very useful for research in various ways. And Irene had two grams of this stuff, very, very small amounts. One of them had actually been given to her by the women of the United States in the 1920s. They held a huge fundraising drive, raised something like $1 million to give this to Irene. So it was very, give it to Marie. So it was very precious to her. And then when the war started, Marie had died at this point. I had been given to Irene. And she ended up having to abandon it at one point in a part of France that was controlled by Nazi Germany. So she realized that the Germans might want to get their hand on it. And she basically took off, kind of went into Nazi territory, basically by herself to try to snatch this radioactive material away from the Germans. So very brave of her to do this. And in some ways, the Nazis sort of, they harmed themselves in that they kind of let her go because she was a woman, someone that they didn't think would really be daring enough to go on these types of adventures. But she did, and she ended up getting the material back.
These people that you cover, there's so many, you know, different characters, and some minor characters and some, you know, characters that we follow pretty closely. They're so human. They make mistakes. They bungle their experiments. They're jealous of each other. They're worried about getting a professorship that's more significant than the next person. And yet there's this war, and they're worried about saving their families and you know, getting themselves to safety, saving their equipment, Nazis taking over their labs.
Right.
You never forget that these are human beings who are flawed. They get drunk. They release secrets that they shouldn't. You know,
they blab too much.
They miss things that are right in front of their noses, just like sort of the rest of us. How was it important to you to make sure that we saw all of these people, including some of the more controversial characters, as complete human beings, really in very difficult times?
Yeah, so I'm a science person. I love science. But I think when we pick up a book, what we really want is stories. We want heroes and villains and flawed people. And I mentioned in the book, you know, sometimes you think they're fighting more against each other than they are the enemy. Like, they're really combating each other a lot of cases. But they always kind of have in mind the goal, which is to keep the bomb out of Adolf Hitler's hands. And eventually, despite all the stumbles, despite all, you know, the mistakes, the blabbing, the personality flaws and things, they do eventually come together, united for this purpose. So there are a lot of human flaws in there. And I think it's important to bring that out in that, you know, it can be kind of hard if you just read this account of someone and they just seem like they're perfect people who've never done anything wrong in their lives. But that's not how people are. Even our heroes have flaws and things. And I think it makes it more realistic, and it also makes it something that we can kind of aspire to if we see even that these heroic people had their flaws and made mistakes and things like that as well.
Let's talk about some of the non-scientists. When we talk about flawed characters, we have to sort of start with Moberg, don't we? This major league baseball catcher, right?
Yeah, Moberg. Yeah. He's one of my favorite characters in the book. As you said, he was a major league baseball catcher, played for about 15 seasons. But he was also a very brilliant person in that he spoke something like a half a dozen languages. Some people said a full dozen. He went to Princeton. He went to the Sorbonne. He did Columbia Law School in the off-season of Major League Baseball games. He was just a brilliant, brilliant person. And one of the, probably no bench warmer, I think, in sports history got as much press attention as Moberg did, because he was so smart, so interesting, and reporters basically just drooled over this guy because he was the most amazing character they'd ever seen. Someone once called him the strangest person to ever play Major League Baseball.
All right, so what does he have to do with keeping the bomb out of Hitler's hands?
So Berg was Jewish, and he had always enjoyed playing baseball, but when World War II broke out, he decided he wanted to do a little more with himself. He was a little too old to join the military at that point. So he ended up joining what's called the Office of Strategic Services, which is kind of the precursor to the CIA of today. And basically, they trained Berg to become an assassin. He could speak all those languages. He knew Europe very well from having traveled there. Ended up going undercover in different places in Europe. And they especially wanted Berg to go after the top scientist on the Nazi atomic bomb project, a man named Werner Heisenberg. So very famous from the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, kind of a legendary scientist working on the Nazi atomic project. And they sent Berg, eventually sent Berg, into a lecture in Zurich, Switzerland, with a pistol in one pocket and a cyanide pill in the other pocket. And his job was, if Heisenberg said anything about them being close to building an atomic bomb, that Berg was supposed to stand up during this scientific lecture and shoot him and kill him in the middle of this lecture. And it was just such a crazy idea.
I mean, we're smiling. There's nothing funny about it, but yeah. it's this bizarreness of what happens during war.
Yeah, I mean, imagine sending like Bryce Harper or LeBron James in as an assassin to try to go after a Nobel Prize winning scientist. I mean, it's a crazy idea, but the idea of Hitler getting the bomb was so awful that they were even willing to consider crazy ideas like this. And that's kind of a theme that pops up over and over in the book. You see all these crazy plots and ideas, but that fear of Hitler was overriding everything, and they just kept going for ideas like this.
So this fear is driving so much of the scientific advancement. Is it also getting in the way of other scientific advance? I mean, it really affects these scientists' lifelong careers to have lived at this particular time.
I think fear probably was more of a driver to them, especially on the Manhattan Project. I don't think they would have risked as much money and worked as hard on the atomic bomb had that fear of Germany not been looming over us this entire time. And it's possible, given how expensive and what a risk it was, they might not have finished it before the war was over had we not been so focused on Nazi Germany. Of course, we ended up using it against Japan during the war. But really, for the scientists involved, it was Germany, the fear of Hitler, that was driving them to work so hard on this bomb.
How are some of these, you mentioned Heisenberg, how were some of these scientists seen afterwards? In Europe, because some of them are sabotaging their own equipment when the Nazis take over and trying to slow down processes. Others are trying to figure out what is the balance between my science and what it's being used for. Mm-hmm. How does history sort of treat a few of them?
There's really been kind of a split in that some people, you know, look to forgive them or explain what was going on, and some people are very unforgiving. They say, you know, they worked for the most reprehensible regime in modern history. There's no reason, there's no way we can forgive them. A lot of people at the time were very angry. Werner Heisenberg knew a lot of people, including people working in the U.S. on our atomic research, and he lost a lot of friendships over this. The fact that he decided to stay in Germany and work for the Nazi regime. So there was a lot of anger, a lot of bitterness over Heisenberg. And again, he ended up losing a lot of friends over this.
Tell us a little bit about some of those desperate actions and coincidences, because there were so many times, I'm thinking of the efforts to go into Norway and to disrupt the plant that's making heavy water. And just some of the coincidences that happen, you know, you've got, you know, operatives on the ground who uncover what happens to be a childhood sled that they had, you know, like hadn't seen in a couple years, and here it is, and now they use it. There's so much of this sort of serendipity, and tell us a little bit about how some of those stories play into what turns out to be success or failures. There's a lot of randomness to war.
Right. Yeah, so this was basically a plot. There was a plant in Germany, or excuse me, a plant in Norway, that was making a substance called heavy water. It's important for atomic research. And this was the only plant in the world that was making this stuff. So the Allies sent in teams of commandos, basically, to try to take out this plant. Some of these didn't work out so well. They were huge disasters. A bunch of people died. Some of them were some of the most brave missions of the war. And in the latter case, they were sending in people who were from the area, who were local Norwegians. And as you mentioned, there was one part where they were trying to drag their heavy equipment to get close to this plant. One of them came across a sled in the snow. It was actually his childhood sled that he had found. Like, he left out there. He had lent it to somebody, and they'd abandoned it. Yeah. So he found his childhood sled, kind of his rosebud, I guess, that ended up dragging it along on this mission and helped them out. Another case, they were on their way, actually, for the sabotage mission. They ran into a bunch of teenagers who were out there, and they happened to know them. Or in another case, they were trying to blow up a ferry where a guard jumped out. He had a gun. He was about to shoot them. And then one of them said, "Newt, is that you?" Like, you recognized him from the athletic club that he worked at home. And so you did have all these coincidences where these personal connections ended up kind of twisting the plot and allowing them to succeed.
And you talk about the bravery of them, but not only are they risking their own lives, but in that case, they're risking the lives of every civilian with a certain radius because of how the Nazis respond to any kind of resistance. So they're dressing as, you know, British soldiers, or trying to sort of, be undercover the rules of the Geneva Convention are not necessarily applying in cases.
No.
Talk a little bit about just the courage of some of these men and women who did really extraordinary things.
Especially on those commando raids, a lot of them, before they left, they would write letters to all their loved ones, and they would say goodbye to them, essentially, because they didn't expect to live through this raid. They thought they were going into this in order to die, and in some cases, some of them had no background in science. They knew, like, the words atomic and nuclear, they meant nothing to them, but all they knew was that this was important, and that it was their job to go in and try to sabotage these plants. So they would write goodbye letters to their families, they would go in there and try to destroy them. And so it's kind of an unimaginable amount of courage to walk into a situation knowing you're probably going to die, but knowing that you have to get this job done first.
Were there things that you just had to leave out, stories that you wish you could have put in to the book that ended up, you know, being edited out?
There were anecdotes and things. I wanted to make sure the book had a momentum, that it was really moving forward and exciting. And there were just some parts I couldn't fit in the book. It would have run on for, you know, hundreds of pages longer. I did manage to actually salvage some of them on my website. So there's a section for notes, extra photographs on the website, and excerpts up there, things like that. So I felt like I could keep them a little bit, even though I had to cut them out of the main narrative thrust of the book.
We should probably mention the Kennedy brothers, because they do play a big part in this book, and I don't think I ever realized the competitiveness for risk-taking that really played into a much grander picture and deeply personal moments as well.
So basically the main Kennedy in this book is Joe Kennedy, JFK's older brother, who basically couldn't stand that his younger brother was a war hero, and decided he had to out-macho his kid brother. And Joe ended up dying on this really crazy side branch of the Manhattan Project, where they filled these planes up, these gigantic planes, with napalm, and basically tried to ram them into atomic bunkers in France.
Yeah, so much at stake there, and there's very delicate moments that impact really world history.
Yeah.
Sam Keen, it's a remarkable book. I said before, I think it's you just keep getting better. It's called The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the renegade scientists and spies who sabotaged the Nazi atomic bomb. Its release date is July 9th. Sam Keen, thanks for stopping by In the Moment. We appreciate it.
All right, thanks for having me.
That's Sam Keen, author of the new book, The Bastard Brigade, the true story of the renegade scientists and spies who sabotaged the Nazi atomic bomb. The book is available in hardcover July 9th. South Dakota showed up for Galen Lee this week when she played the Levitt Concert Venue in Sioux Falls. She's an NPR Tiny Desk Contest winner, an author, a musician, and a woman living with brittle bone disease, which means she plays her violin slightly differently than what you're used to seeing. What makes her different is just part of what makes her remarkable. She joined us to talk about music, disability pride, and dismantling obstacles for all people through smart policy and strong advocacy. So tell me a little bit, and we're going to talk a lot about music, but I want to start with some of the work that you're doing off stage here in the community about disability pride, disability rights, and music. Tell me a little bit about what you've been up to.
Well, I got into touring because of music, but then it kind of was a nice segue to be able to do more advocacy work. So about 6 months before I won the Tiny Desk, I gave my first talk about disability awareness and disability pride and disability advocacy. And it was at a conference of health and human service workers. So they're people who pretty often come in contact with people with disabilities. And a lot of the feedback was like, wow, I never thought about it this way, or I've never heard the idea of disability pride. And I was like, oh my goodness, these are the people working with people with disabilities, and it's like not in the mainstream consciousness yet. So I started speaking as often as I could about those issues, because I just think there's a really big hole in terms of our awareness about the history of disability and like disability rights. I think people think, oh, well, it's taken care of because we have the ADA, but there's still a lot of barriers. If you look at the measures, economic and sociological measures that we use to talk about inequality, people with disabilities are, like, it's really unequal still across the board for people with disabilities. So it's like, let's talk about it.
Yeah. And how does that play out? What are some of the ways that you see the evidence of that inequality?
Well, the unemployment rate is much higher, and it depends on how you look at it, right? So if you're talking about people actively looking for work who have disabilities, they're twice as likely to be unemployed. But if you're talking about the general working age population, people with disabilities are like, it's between 60 and 70% unemployed, which is, I mean, a huge number, right? And so obviously not everyone with a disability is going to work or looking for work, but how creative are we being? Like, how supportive? How much discrimination has kind of discouraged people from looking? Like, what are the factors? Like, why is that number so high? And the people who are looking for work, their unemployment rate is twice as high. So, like, yeah. Either way you look at it, the numbers are not good. But like, let's be having this discussion. I think with employment specifically, people who look at the ADA say, well, if I try this accommodation and it doesn't work, then I can let this person go without getting sued. But really, the ADA was made by awesome radical advocates, right? These are people who are like, let's try to make it possible for people to work and get the conditions that they need to do a good job. So it's not like, let's meet this minimum requirement and then we don't have to worry about it. It's like, no, like, you can go above and beyond the ADA.
Right.
That's a minimum. You know what I'm saying? And so thinking about how to get people in, I'm encouraged, or I have hope that with the internet, being able to work remotely could be a really positive thing for the disability community, because people could get jobs and then work from home, especially if you have like chronic illness.
Sure.
And you can't come in every single day, but you can definitely contribute, you know, to a workplace. I mean, there are some studies that say people with disabilities are actually more loyal employees than the non-disabled population. So, I mean, why is that? I don't know. It's a very complex issue, but the idea that people with disabilities can certainly contribute, you know, to a workplace, but it might need to look a little bit different, and right. That's kind of
right.
That's one of the major ones.
Yeah, the first conversation should not be about whether or not you'll get sued.
Yeah, exactly. But honestly, I mean, I have a college degree. I was really involved in school, and I had two really like eye-opening experiences. One of them, the guy said, well, now that I see you, I don't think you can do this job. I mean, like, that was literally like, hello, now that I see you, I don't think you can do this job. So that was like the beginning of my interview. And first of all, so I spent the rest, that's illegal, first of all, by the way, in case you're wondering. And then I spent the rest of the interview trying to justify like the ways that he could accommodate, which just isn't the way
an interview. And what kind of job, what sort of field were you looking in?
It was working for the housing service, and so he was concerned I couldn't go door to door, but I was like, couldn't I bring a PCA to like knock on the door?
Right.
And he's like, I guess so, but it's just like, that's not the way anyone else's interview went, obviously, you know. Right. What I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other experience was after I left the room, the employer asked if I would scare the kids, which again isn't appropriate anyways, but then I didn't know that it happened. The only reason I found out is because employee had been really upset by it and told me that it happened. But so I think discrimination happens behind closed doors as well. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So I don't want to let that go. Let's talk a little bit more about that. that really blatant comment about that must be something that as you do this work, you hear from other people with a wide variety of disabilities who have heard that comment made to them, or people who have said things to them
that are just really inappropriate.
Yep. What do you give them direct advice on how to handle comments like that?
I mean, I don't know. Sometimes you're so like flabbergasted in the moment that you're like, oh my gosh, I just don't know what to say. You know, I don't know if I have a direct, like, I mean, I think it's good to, if you have the wherewithal in your mind, like, in that moment to say, like, that wasn't appropriate, that's one thing. But, like, in my case, I don't know what I would have, if I had been in the room, I don't know what I would have said, because mm-hmm. it really catches you off guard to be like, oh, that's what's happening right now. You know what I mean?
Right. Starting from that level.
Yeah, like, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's where, and so that's just what gives me the passion to do what I'm doing, because I don't think that that's the majority of the population necessarily. I don't know. But the fact that that kind of negative thinking is so close to the surface of where we are. Mm. Like, I think people think, oh, we've come a long ways. And in a lot of ways, we have. You know, like, I'm not going to say the ADA didn't make positive changes or the Rehabilitation Act and all these things have made gains, but there's this underlying, and this is the big thing, that I want to write a book about it, actually. Like, I'm working on, like, outlining it right now, but about, like, the idea is that if so close to the surface all this negative view of disability exists, well, first of all, that colors my life and the life of everyone else who has to deal with that thinking on a regular basis, right? But it also teaches me that, like, there's a really big disconnect in the current, especially among advocates, the current, like, thinking of disability and the rest of society. So the current, like, disability advocacy movement, they see disability, like I do, like, as diversity. It's a form, and, like, we celebrate diversity, right? We're not, I mean, we should be anyways. We're trying to, like, realize that that's important. So celebrating diversity is, it's such a different way to approach it, right? So you can talk about disability pride and the contributions that people with disabilities have made and their perspectives that are unique and positive that have, like, helped. You know, my TED Talks, both of them, I wouldn't have written if I hadn't, like, been me, right? Like, with my life experience. And I owe a lot of that to being disabled and just having a different worldview, and that it can be really positive. So little kids, for example, who are being raised right now in loving families, I mean, I can't say that every family is doing this, but the ones that I've met that are empowered, their parents are telling them, you're fine the way you are, and you're awesome, and you can do what you want to do. We just need to have the proper support in place so they don't see their disability as, like, a negative necessarily. I mean, a lot of the kids I've met are, like, ahead of where most adults are with disability in terms of just, like, self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. But then society really needs to catch up then, because those kids are going to get into the adult world and be like, what? Like, you know what I mean? Like, right. This is what you guys are talking about? You know, because they're not, like, pitying themselves or, like, feeling sad about their conditions or whatever. They've actually, like, moved beyond that. But I don't think mainstream society talks about it enough to even, like, have that realization.
And it's not as if necessarily all those kids were protected in a family. They were empowered, which
exactly.
is an entirely different thing.
Very
and then
different.
They come
yep.
into a place where that empowerment doesn't exist, and that's the you know, that's the starting line.
Yeah, and so if I see my disability as just a part of myself that it's brought me to where I am, and that I think every life matters, and that everyone can contribute in their own unique way, and it doesn't have to look like capitalism all the time. If I walk around feeling that way, but then, yeah, you come against. It's just, I mean, I think a lot of minorities experience those moments where they're like, whoa, like, that is not my worldview at all. But the problem with disability is even the people who work with disabled people don't always know about disability pride. Like, usually at my speeches, I ask people to raise their hand if they've ever heard of disability pride before. And it's like a very small percentage of people that do. So it's just getting the word out there. I don't think people in general don't want to do a better job. It's that they're not being given any information.
So when we talk about entering the workforce, one of the things I want to talk about is your career in music. And just entering the workforce as an artist, as a self-employed artist, as an artist who's supported by other people, as a touring artist. How did you get into music? How did that sort of become part of the way you were expressing your creativity?
It was a very windy path. I started in public school orchestra. So, again, I was really, really lucky. I had a creative teacher who was like, you know, I couldn't play the violin on my shoulder. Mm-hmm. Because my arms and legs are shorter, and so I just couldn't reach where the fingerboard was. And so she and I kind of developed a different style of playing together that I play up and down like a cello and hold my bow like a bass player. And that's just because she was willing to think outside the box. And then I was lucky to have supportive teachers all the way through, so I like to talk to teachers about, like, It doesn't have to look the same. The goal is the sound, right? So I had teachers that were willing to help me figure out how to make the sound as good as possible, right? Even though my technique was pretty different. And then after that, I got into fiddle, and I always just saw music as a hobby. I started performing in 2008 or so, but I started writing my own music in 2011. And with a guy named Alan Sparhawk, he's in the band Low. I was really fortunate to meet him, and we still do sometimes get to play together. We had a project that was pretty active around that time. That's when I started looping, mm-hmm. Which is that recording device that layers right. up the layers yeah. of sound on my violin. And so that was all up to that point, even 2013. Music was pretty much just a hobby. I played a lot, like 6 or 8 times a month, but it was all local. And then in 2013, I just kind of had an epiphany, like I wanted to be self-employed. Because of the employment barriers, I was sort of topping out at $10 an hour. I wasn't getting promoted, which again is a problem. But for me, the way around it was like, well, I should do something. I should be self-employed. And so I had a friend I was talking to her, and I was like, ah, I wish there was something I can do that people would pay me for. And she's like, you play the violin. You should teach people how to do that.
Tell us about that NPR Tiny Desk Contest 2016. You won the big thing.
Yeah, it was so weird.
Like, that's it. Yeah, that's the holy grail of this thing.
Yeah.
And it's you. Do they call you? How do they let
you
know?
It was so surreal. They, you know, I was teaching lessons at the time, so I had 2 lessons in the afternoon, and in between the lessons, I checked my email. I had entered about a month before. They don't tell you anything. You just submit it on YouTube and entered their little form, and that's all, basically. And I got an email saying, this is NPR, we want to talk to you. And I had read somewhere that the way they did the contest was they divided all the videos up between the staffers, and then each staffer picks like 5 of their favorite ones, and then all of them watch 50 videos.
Okay.
And I thought maybe I was being told that I was one of the 50, and I was really excited. Like, I remember shaking, like, when I read the email, and I was like, oh my gosh, I think I might be a finalist. And then they set up a phone call, and it was Bob Boylan on the other end of the line. And at the beginning, he's just like, you know, I listened to your first album. I had just released an album. It all kind of like converged at this time. I had just released my first solo album. And he's like, I was listening to your album, and I really like the way you experiment with these traditional fiddle tunes. And so I realized, like, Bob Boylan had listened to my album, and I was like, what is going on? And he's like, and I wanted to let you know that we wanted to choose you as the winner. And it was just really weird. I mean, I remember it. Like, I don't think I'll ever forget it. It was a cool, cool moment.
So let's talk about the book that you want to write. And you are a big reader yourself, and you did a TED Talk about sort of these self-help books and personal development books and goal setting and how that's limited in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about what some of the problems or challenges are about the sort of traditional self-development literature right now, and then we'll pivot into what you're working on or what you hope to be working on in a book that bring something new to the conversation.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So I read a lot of self-help and psychology and spirituality, and when you get into the self-help realm, although some of the tips are useful, obviously, and motivational, and I'm not saying that they haven't ever been helpful, it did become clear, though, that they're talking to a very specific audience of, like, probably able-bodied people that are able to set a goal and have the independence and stamina or whatever to, like, go after a goal and cross it off the list, mm-hmm. you know, and that idea is harmful in a couple ways because, like, first of all, you're not everybody has, like, that exact situation in their life. You know, when I break my bones, because I have brittle bones disease, I haven't broken one in about 5 or 6 years, but I do periodically. like, I just break easier. So, like, it's like all of a sudden all the plans you had are, like, totally out the window for the next 6 to 12 weeks because you're recovering and I need a lot of help when I can't, like, move both arms, right? So, so it just, it doesn't apply to you, this idea of, like, all the things you have planned in your checklist and you're, like, breaking your goals down into manageable tasks. That doesn't mean anything when you're recovering, right? Or when you're not well. And then the other thing is that it kind of feeds into this idea, which is subtle to me. It took me a while to, like, I heard somebody talk about it, and I was like, oh, that's totally true. In our society, we value, like, our worth on what we contribute, and we define contributing pretty concretely. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, I did this, and this is how I contributed, rather than just being a little more holistic. Like, I met a man at a bank maybe only a month ago. It wasn't that long ago. We were both in line, and some guy was saying, blah, blah, I don't know, like, what do you do? And he's like, well, I used to be useful. Mm-hmm. You know, and that idea of, like, what you can do is what you, how you are valuable. Again, it leaves a lot of people out. So not just people with disabilities, but people approaching the end of life, for example, or just aging in general. Mm-hmm. It kind of just says, well, you're valuable as long as you can, like, produce or do things in a traditional sense, like check things off the list, yeah. Right? And so, yeah, so that's what kind of inspired me to talk about the TED Talk is, like, if we're really serious about talking about a worthwhile existence or, like, a meaningful life or a fulfilling life, I don't think we can, like, leave anyone out of the paradigm. So that's when I came up with the idea of the enrichment. So either you're enriching your own life by doing an activity, and it doesn't have to be related to your job at all. Like, that's the key, is it doesn't have to be, like, I did this for my work, and it was enriching. It can be, like, I gardened on the side, and it was enriching, you know? Or you can be the receiver of passive enrichment, which is when when you're not even able to, like, enrich your life yourself, other people can still engage with you in ways that make your life enriching. And I have some firsthand experience with that. Like, when I was 18, I ended up having to have a very big back surgery. I have pretty bad scoliosis, and they had to stabilize it. And because of the way my bones are, I was on bed rest for 6 weeks. Mm. No, 2 months. It was a long time. But I don't remember that time negatively, ironically. Like, I thought that I would for sure, but my friends made it enriching. So they would come over every day after school. I was a senior in high school, and they would lay in my hospital bed with me, and we would just talk for, like, 5 hours. And so other people, you know, were there to help my life still be enriching. Right. And I would like to think that in return, they also were enriched because we were enjoying each other's company. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't have to be all one way.
Right.
But the idea that that period of time, even though I wasn't accomplishing any quote-unquote goals, I still think of that as an enriching time in my life. Like, I actually look back at it fondly in a weird way. It was like it ended up being kind of like a unique snapshot of, like, really close friends being there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So enrichment can be you doing it yourself or other people bringing something to the table that, you know, especially in a thoughtful way.
And let's go back to that concept that you talked about earlier about why we celebrate diversity and those different points of view, because that story that you just told has something to offer everyone that could potentially be life-changing if you, you know, heard that and said, I'm going to spend 5 hours laying and, you know, laying on the couch with my friends just talking. That has value. That's something that you thought of because you had an experience.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I just think that that's what I mean by disability pride is I think that a lot of really cool things, like ways of looking at the world, come from, like, very different lived experiences. And if you say, well, this experience is bad, and you don't take time to listen to, like, how it actually can be helpful to other people, you know, then, yeah, you're missing out. It's kind of like limiting the colors of the rainbow. You know what I mean? It's So I think that was a really big eye-opener. The other thing is my grandfather was in hospice a few years later, and he was passing away. He had been, oh, he was 94, and he was ready to be done. And we have a huge family, and we're all there the entire time. Like, he was never actually alone at all the whole 6 days. We were joking that maybe he wanted some quiet time or whatever, but we were all there, and every day after work, I would play my violin for him. And one day, he hadn't spoken in 3 days, and I was playing Amazing Grace, and he started moaning, and we were worried, so the nurse came in, and she leaned over, and she's like, oh my gosh, he's singing with you. And by the end of the song, he was singing very loudly. Like, I mean, it was really obvious he was singing Amazing Grace, and then he never spoke again, and that was his last words. I mean, he was alive for a few. It was very powerful. I know, it was, it's kind of hard to talk about, but the thing, the thing that that made me realize is that passive enrichment, like, literally actually applies to everyone. Like, not just, like, your good friend who is totally cognizant of everything. It actually applies to everyone. So, like, people with developmental disabilities, people in hospice, people with Alzheimer's, like, they, everybody can appreciate the presence of other people. And that is another thing that I think is just, like, kind of important to remember as a society, especially if we're talking about, like, taking care of everybody. Doing it with compassion is a huge part of that. Not pity, not disdain, not like, oh, this is such a burden. You know, like, realizing that you, like, how much different would his death have been if he was alone in a room by himself than with his, like, family? You know what I mean? So everybody can appreciate it, which is why I think, to me, even though it's still, you get wrapped up in the, like, goals and blah, blah, blah. Like, at the root of it all, like, to come back to remember, like, enrichment is actually a better way to, like, judge, because it can apply to anyone.
That's Galen Lee. Find her online at violinscratches.com. All artists at some point consider the impact of their art in the world. How is the work you are creating changing people's lives? Do you want your art to have that kind of impact? And how do you create an authentic expression in music, in photography, in words? Norma and Jerry Wilson are writers deeply connected to the natural world. They live together in a geosolar house in southeast South Dakota, and they write poetry and books that not only honor that connection, they also think deeply about what they want to say about politics, about the environment, about the human condition. They joined us in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios. Norma and Jerry, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate you making the trip to Sioux Falls to spend the hour with us.
We appreciate being invited.
Thank you, Laura. It's our pleasure.
And I want to start, Norma, with this new book, Frog Creek Road, because this is your latest poetry collection. Tell us a little bit about finding a home for these poems. They've been, many have been in publications and then now in this collection.
That's right. I think this collection of poems has been written over a period of 36 years.
Wow.
So that's a long time. And the poems have been published in various places, including South Dakota Magazine. And I really appreciate having a publisher here in Sioux Falls with Scurfpee Publishing, Steve Boynt, who appreciates poetry about this area. Yeah. And so I put them all together because I realized, particularly in writing Rivers, Wings, and Sky, which is about the southeastern corner of South Dakota and the ecosystem in that area, how much I appreciated living in my own place. In fact, it wasn't the first time I'd realized that because, you know, having lived there, having built the house and raised our two children there, it's just, I'm part of the place and it's part of me and I belong to it. And so I ended up writing a seasonal book. Begins in winter and it goes through the season of spring, summer, and then into fall. And I realized at first I was dividing it into different parts, and then I thought, no, that's not the way it happens. It's just the seasons flow. And so that's what the poems do. And I know that probably in future books I'll come back to my home, but this is the one that's really about this place that I love to be. I love to live there and come back when I've traveled somewhere else.
And it's, talk a little, if you will, about how important it is. You mentioned Scurfpee and just the fact that there is publishing here, from here, that's getting published here. Without that, that might not exist in the same way. It would be a great loss. How valuable is it to have the poetry of this place be published from this place?
Yeah. Why are so many stories, novels, poems set in New York City? Well, that's where the publishers are. And I think that that's, you know, that's the idea. So if we don't have publishers here, it's hard to find an audience. Not that we can't write, and I'm hoping that some of these poems, I mean, I know that they reach beyond just the place where I live, to because I have attachments, connections to other places. In fact, I was born in Tennessee, and I lived in Oklahoma for quite some time, too, before coming here. But I feel that to be really aware of the world and understand it, there's no better way to learn than through travel. So I love to travel as well. And yet, why? I mean, I'm not sure why, you know, the ordinary life in this place isn't more interesting to people, because it's a very special place where I live. Mm-hmm. There's more of the natural world left on our place than in much of the United States. In fact, when Jerry and I travel to other places, when we come back home, Jerry's always saying, well, I've seen more wild animals here than I've seen on our whole trip. And that'll be as we're going up the hill toward our house, all the deer are appearing. And then there's a few raccoons and turkeys coming out. So, you know, it's a very special place. I want to write about it. And thank goodness there's a publisher. There are more than one publisher interested in this, but we're very lucky to have one in Sioux Falls. It's easier to promote your books if the publisher is right here, because you've got a comrade who's helping.
Right. I'm hoping you might read one of the poems from this new collection, Frog Creek Road, and I'm looking at page 22, a poem called Making Our Home on the Prairie, because I mentioned the house that you both live in and how you built this in the early 80s. And this is a little something that sort of helps put us all in that place. It's very, very specific, and yet it's very universal at the same time, which good poetry is.
Sure, I'll read this poem. Making Our Home on the Prairie. After searching in all directions for a solar building site, we find a south-facing hill on Frog Creek Road for sale. I love at first sight the view of Jerry gazing at the vast surrounding prairie and all that I survey. Exploring the 40, we find a seasonal creek, a pond and spring, wild plum, sumac, walnut, elm, mulberry, box elder, hackberry, and chokecherry trees, but no trees to shelter our house from wind and snow. We buy the land in a tractor, and early that spring, Jerry plows a crescent of earth above our home site, and we plant 1,000 saplings in 7 rows to crown our hill. Pine, honeysuckle, ash, Russian olive, maple, locust, and lilac. It rains, rains, rains until late May. Impatiently, we prepare. And as soon as the earth is dry, our burrow is dug and building begins. Each morning, we load the pickup with tools, a stack of diapers, our toddler, a pot of soup, and our dog Bounce. We work until noon, take a sandwich break, then I lie down in the tent, coaxing Walt to take a nap. One day, as we duck inside, he says, "Mousie." 2 mice scurry out of our tent. Walt is too excited to fall asleep, so we walk through the grasses to look for them.
Jerry, I want to bring you into the conversation because you too have written about this place that you live, and you too have written about the seasons as they change. Tell us what, for you, is so captivating about this little spot in South Dakota that really is a metaphor for so much more about our planet.
This is probably kind of a historic occurrence that Scurf P Publishing here in Sioux Falls, Steve Boynt, published both of these books, and they're similar in some ways in that they're both a seasonal book going through a calendar year, except that mine is prose, Norma's is poetry. I have always been a keen observer of nature and a lover of all things natural. So this place has always been special to me. But then over the years, the 36 or 7 years that we've lived there, we've had opportunities to buy some adjacent land so that now we have a substantial piece of property along the Missouri River Bluff. And we have been working bit by bit over about the last quarter century to restore native prairie on all of the flatter lands. Much of it is hilly and wooded and deep ravines and water, but we now have native prairie restored to most of the open land. So it's once again resembling the prairie that the settlers might have found when they first arrived. Can't ever be complete because too many species have been lost. There are too many invaders, but it's a beautiful thing to see, and to see the full-scale ecosystem of mammals and birds that have evolved with this reinvigorated prairie, and that's one of the things that I love most.
I'm hoping you might read from Seasons of the Coyote. This is a year on the Prairie Bluff, and as we're recording this, the week of the 4th of July, and people are getting ready for their own Independence Day rituals. You spent some time really thinking about natural land and history and the future. So would you read a little bit from that section of this book, please?
Sure. So this is the July 4th entry, and it's called Independence Day, Protecting Natural Land. Today is Independence Day, a day when Americans celebrate freedom from the tyranny of foreign rule. We conveniently forget that we are also a nation built by invaders, by non-natives on this land. Here in southeastern South Dakota, that invasion began when white settlers displaced the Yankton Sioux, beginning in 1859 and rapidly accelerating with the passage of the Homestead Act 3 years later. Homesteaders brought vigor and hard work and many admirable values and skills to the land they possessed, but they also brought non-native seeds, sometimes inappropriate land use, and in some cases, disregard for both the peoples they dispossessed and for the long-term needs of the land they claimed. A century and a half later, little is left that might remind us of the rich cultural and natural world they inherited. Given the tiny fraction of native prairie that remains, prairie is perhaps the most degraded ecosystem in North America. Norma and I and our children are well aware of how blessed our lives have been in our country and on this scrap of prairie bluff and woods, where remnants of that natural world remain and where we have had the opportunity to work at restoring some of what was lost. After 35 years of walking trails, listening to birds, and sitting in meditation at the spring, I have not stopped asking myself, what did I do to deserve this? Yes, we lived frugally and saved money so that when the opportunity to buy land arose, we could act. Yes, we actively pursued opportunities that make things happen as they did. And yes, we have invested thousands of hours of labor building our home, rescuing land from the encroachment of invasive grasses, weeds, and cedar trees, and to the best of our abilities, rehabilitating abused soil through the restoration of native grasses and forbs. But there was also a huge element of good fortune. More than once, we were simply in the right place at the right time. But the work continues. Every year we make the rounds, cutting down young cedars that have sprung from seeds deposited by female cedars I removed years ago. Many springs we have gathered friends to burn selected meadows to enhance and maintain the prairie's health. Every June, I walk the prairie with a sweep net, gathering leafy spurge-eating flea beetles to release in yet another area threatened by the persistent weed. Every July, we scour the prairies and woods, loppers or hoe in hand, removing other invaders that refuse to die. We are under no illusion that our land has been or could be restored to its truly natural condition. We are aware that our work has, to a large extent, been an artificial exercise. It is the paradox of conservation that the best human efforts to truly restore natural conditions will not be adequate. We simply have done what we could do as we had the insight and energy to act. But for how much longer can we wield these tools, climb prairie hills, and perform these tasks? If we are fortunate and health holds out, perhaps a decade or two, or perhaps not. These days, my thankful meditations are often clouded by these questions. Indeed, I am sometimes gripped by anxiety when I ask myself, who will carry on these vital responsibilities when we cannot? I find no obvious answer. Perhaps these feelings are not so different from those experienced by women and men who have invested their lives in building institutions or even successful businesses. Certainly, I understand the angst of aging farmers who have carefully nurtured their land in the midst of an agribusiness revolution that has turned every farm around them into a profit-driven sea of monoculture, land that in many cases is managed by someone who neither owns nor lives upon the land, but is driven solely by the amount of profit that can be squeezed from this year's crop of corn and beans. And yet, our blessing and our commitment are different. Norma and I have been entrusted with what is an increasingly rare island of diversity, an irregular swath of water, woods, and prairie hills that has grown in health while most surrounding land has been neglected, abused, or turned into a medium for the annual injection of chemicals and engineered seeds. So what to do?
So what to do? Do you have an answer as you lay out sort of, you know, the nuances of the problem so eloquently?
We have a longtime friend named John Davidson, a retired environmental law professor from the University of South Dakota, who years ago founded the Northern Prairies Land Trust. And for many years, we discussed the possibility of putting our land into a conservation easement. And so on about the 4th of July, a few years back, we did execute such an agreement. So all of our property is now in a perpetual conservation easement so that when we are no longer able to take care of it, it is legally protected from inappropriate development. The legal document spells out what can't be done there, what can't happen there, but there is no way to determine from beyond the grave what must be done, and that's the dilemma, is, you know, who will carry on the necessary work to maintain this property in as near natural condition as possible. That's an unanswered question.
One of the things that I found so powerful was the foreword of the book by David Allen Evans, our former South Dakota poet laureate, and he, or the introduction to the book, and he really made a comparison to Mary Oliver and the connection that she had with nature. And one of the things I love about that comparison is it's not just a poetry comparison, but it's sort of a, you know, when I think of Mary Oliver, I think of her in the woods sort of gathering mushrooms. And as I read this book, I, you know, here you are, you know, as a little wet duck underneath, you know, you're crawling around on your, on the land, and you're sort of doing some of those things that are, not only are you writing about nature, but you're part of it, in the mud, in the dirt, in the rain, with the creatures. Do you like that comparison?
When I love it. I really appreciated Dave's introduction to my book. I mean, his response to it. I felt so honored.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I'm on page 37, Awake with the Wildflowers, and I think this is a great poem to sort of illustrate that comparison a little bit, if you would mind reading Awake with Wildflowers for us.
Awake with Wildflowers. Jerry and Walter have gone to bed, but I am awake with wildflowers I found in the ditch today when I went out with a staple gun to reattach the stop spraying sign someone or the wind had ripped away. Though I went on behalf of the Forbes, I took the hoe also to chop down thistles. Along the way, I made a wild bouquet of meadow rose, western wallflower, snow on the mountain, bracted spiderwort, blue lettuce, creeping jenny, vervain, pale purple coneflower, and prairie milkweed. I chopped down all the wavy leaf thistles I found, but kept one fragrant and large magenta blossom, like the poisonous purple flower in Rappaccini's Daughter, for my bouquet. While brushing my hair tonight, I see in the eye of my mind the girl inside me budding like a meadow rose on the prairie that will be her home. And of course, that poem was written during the time I was pregnant with Laura, and that first summer when we were working on the place and building the house, and I would go out and chop thistles, but I had to admit that I thought the blossom of the wavy leaf thistle was rather beautiful. And I thought, I was, of course, preparing to teach that fall. I taught American literature in the fall, and I taught the first part in which one of my favorite stories was Hawthorne's Rappaccini's Daughter. So that came into the poem, too.
Let's transition to Eden to Orizaba, because this is fiction. Now we're in your fictional world, and there are ties in this book to the city of Sioux Falls in South Dakota, because some of the characters have connections there. But this is really a book about the other and seeing one another for more than our first impression. Tell us a little bit about what inspired this book, because it becomes more and more relevant in 2019 as we deal with issues of immigration and issues along the southern border of separation and violence and despair, really.
For most of my adult life, I've considered Mexico my other country, my second country. I've traveled there 30 times at least, all over the country. I love the country and the people, and I am distressed by the crises at the border, but also the crises behind it, the poverty and violence and so on that are driving the immigration, and by our government's response to it, or failure to respond adequately. And so two or three years ago, I decided to go to a particular part of Mexico to do some exploring. Just below Mexico's highest peak, 18,600 foot Orizaba, southeast of Mexico City, I learned that there is a place where, after NAFTA, Smithfield Foods Corporation sort of dumped a million pigs on unsuspecting villagers. And exactly 10 years ago now, in 2009, that's where the global swine flu epidemic began. So I particularly wanted to investigate that, and I think with my fiction, it usually begins with investigating the historical reality, and then I try to tell a story in a way that maybe will make that a little more real for readers. One of the two central characters in Eden to Orizaba is Pablo, and the Eden in the title is a real place in Texas, a small town west of Austin, where one of the many contract prisons is located, and that's where Pablo was put after he was arrested for crossing the Rio Grande on his way to Sioux Falls to work, ironically, for the same corporation that has brought all the pigs to his valley. He's left his new bride behind. He's desperate to find a way to make some money, to particularly now that his sister and others are coming down sick from the swine flu that's infected the village of Victoria where they live. And so I could introduce Pablo by reading from the second chapter where we first meet him. He has no money, so he is, as many, many other Mexicans and Central Americans have done, is riding the beast, La Bestia, which is the freight train to the border. It's a very dangerous way to get there, but if you have no money, it's kind of the only way besides walking. So I'll read that section. Pablo caught the van and the local bus to Orizaba, where he filled his backpack with provisions for the journey, tortillas, fruits, 2 cans of beans, and 1 liter of water. He figured he could refill the bottle along the way. He waited behind a rail yard warehouse. When the train rounded the bend, crouching figures disappeared, flattening themselves on boxcar roofs. The train slowed and he raced across the tracks, grabbed a ladder, and swung himself up. He climbed to the top, only to find the car covered by prone bodies. The next vehicle back held just 2. Without any calculation, he leaped across the divide to that car, the momentum of the train carrying him across the 10-foot chasm under which steel wheels screeched and ground against creaking rails. Pablo hit the flat steel roof on hands and knees, skidded and rolled, and came to rest dangerously close to the edge. He pulled himself to the center and lay panting for breath. A sharp pain seared his back. A can of beans had broken his headlong tumble. He dragged his pack off and opened it. 1 can was deeply dented and seeped juice onto his spare jeans, underwear, and shirt. The bananas were smashed flat. The oranges and avocados had fared a little better. He pulled a kerchief from his pocket and cleaned up the mess as best he could. He stood the ruptured can upright, hoping it would leak no more. Pablo now had leisure to survey his circumstances. The knot of people in the car in front of him were all facing his way, their faces contorted by what looked like fear. Glancing back, he saw why. Besides his 2 fellow riders, a 3rd had appeared and was now approaching him with a gun in his hand. "Dame el dinero," the man snarled. The gun was now at Pablo's head. "Ahora," the man shouted. "Give me your money now." Pablo reached into the pocket his mother had sewed inside his belt. Why had he kept the small roll of pesos all in one place? If only he'd stashed some in his shoe. Too late now. The man smacked Pablo's forehead with the pistol, and Pablo handed over the money. The man spat in his face, stuck the roll in his pocket, and prepared to leap to the car Pablo had vacated, the roof where two dozen people recoiled in terror. A pair of boys jumped from the boxcar and skidded down the embankment. The thief turned his back to spring, and without a single thought, Pablo stood and swung his backpack with all his might, striking the thug in the lower back. The robber sailed, spread-eagled, into the abyss, the pistol flying from his hand. His body glanced off the wall of the now speeding boxcar and careened screaming to where steel wheels met tracks. Pablo felt a tiny bump in the split second the body was severed and the upper half expelled in a burst of blood, body parts, the gun, and a flurry of bills scattering down the embankment. A great cheer arose from the crowded car ahead, shouts of "Gracias, amigo, gracias a Dios." Pablo sank to the steel roof. What had he done? He had just killed a man. The thought of taking another human life had never entered his head, and yet a man was surely dead and at his hand. He began to weep. A very long journey had just begun, and now he was a murderer. His money pouch was empty, even his food mostly ruined. He raised his head, and the smoky diesel wind blew the tears from his eyes. The loud commotion continued from the other car. A woman threw flowers across toward him with a shout of joy. Marigolds sailed across the abyss and scattered on the wind. Now the two who shared his boxcar were at his side. Boys, really, younger than him, probably not more than 16. They embraced him and joined in his tears. But then one opened a plastic bag and produced a loaf of bread. He tore it in three pieces and handed one to Pablo. The trio clung to the roof in gathering darkness and munched the drying bread.
Are you optimistic about the future?
Yeah, what else can you be? Otherwise, you know, pessimism is not really an option because it leads to inaction. You know, I grew up in a very remote area of Oklahoma, so I grew up in nature and have always appreciated nature, but political awareness evolved much more slowly, and particularly, I guess, during the Vietnam War and my time in the Army, I really started thinking for myself, and it's a continual process of education, self-education, and thinking things through and not taking what politicians or anybody else tell you for granted. As Norma says, we're all in this together. We have a commitment. We have a responsibility, particularly those of us who have blessed lives.
Norma Wilson's latest poetry collection is called Frog Creek Road. Jerry Wilson's latest book is Eden to Orizaba. The In the Moment Arts podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow us on Instagram at @SDPBInTheMoment. And on Twitter at In the Moment. Know an artist we should feature on the show? Send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.